In just a moment, Generations with Kevin Swanson. But first, this. The World View in 5 minutes.
It's Monday, November 16th, 2015 AD. This is The World View in 5 minutes. I'm Adam McManus. Political correctness has gotten so bad, the ACLU has thrown a flag. On Thursday, it announced it plans to battle atheist group Freedom From Religion Foundation, which is calling for the removal of Gideon Bibles from state-run hotels. ACLJ Chief Counsel Jay Sekulow said, "No one is making any guest open the Bible. They unbelievably claim to be proselytized in the privacy of their own bedrooms. Who knew a closed Bible's mere presence qualified as proselytizing?" Reminds me of my recent stay at the Holiday Inn and Suites in Des Moines, Iowa, where when I pulled open the two drawers next to the bed, there was no Gideon Bible. I called housekeeping, and they said their policy had changed within the last year not to provide the Bibles in the bedrooms. I encouraged them to reconsider that decision and please bring me a Bible so I could read one. Last Christmas was the first time in 2,000 years bells did not ring in the city of Mosul, Iraq. A new study by the Catholic group, Aid to the Church in Need, says unless something drastic happens soon, they may never ring again. More than 1.2 of the 1.5 million Christians who lived in Iraq have been killed by ISIS or have fled, the study said. More than a dozen Christian families leave Iraq daily. Fear not. This is a temporary setback for the Church of Iraq. One day, every knee shall bow and every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. Philippians 2:10. Suicide bombers exploding. Black-garbed ISIS militants spraying machine gun fire. The blood of 129 dead running through the streets of Paris, France. It may seem like the scenes of a dystopian futuristic movie, but tragically, this is reality in France. President Francois Hollande, who was at the soccer stadium where one of the many attacks occurred Friday night, has called the bloodletting an act of war and closed his country's borders. Vowing revenge against ISIS for the country's worst violence since World War II, he said, quote, "We will lead the fight and we will be ruthless," unquote.
What happened yesterday in Paris and Saint-Denis, close to the stadium of France, was an act of war. And faced with war, the country must take appropriate decisions.
23-year-old California student Noemi Gonzalez is the first American to be identified among the dead. Another American, Helen Jane Wilson of Louisiana, was undergoing surgery on Saturday after being shot in the leg at the Eagles of Death metal concert where 89 died. Pastor James McConnell of Ireland is standing trial for calling Islam satanic and heathen last December as he spoke at Whitewell Metropolitan Tabernacle in Belfast.
Islam's ideas about God, about humanity, about salvation are vastly different from the teaching of the Holy Scriptures. Islam is heathen. Islam is satanic. Islam is a doctrine spawned in hell.
McConnell sent out an appeal to Muslims and Christians alike to support him, saying he in no way advocates Muslims not to be allowed to practice their faith. He said, quote, "I appeal to every child of God and every minister of God. If I am put in prison, then in a sense you are also put in prison with me, for every sermon you preach and record will be examined and scrutinized," unquote. On Friday, the U.S. Supreme Court announced it will hear arguments on the constitutionality of Texas's House Bill 2. Signed into law by then-Governor Rick Perry in 2013, it banned abortions after 20 weeks and requires abortionists to obtain hospital admitting privileges and clinic owners to upgrade their facilities to the cleanliness and safety standards of all other Texas surgical centers. 50% of the abortion mills in Texas closed their doors, resulting in a 13% decrease in the number of abortions over the next 12 months. Officials in several counties in Tennessee are lining up to tell the U.S. Supreme Court they will not be bullied into accepting homosexual marriage. Johnson County officials voted to affirm and go on record that Johnson County is vehemently opposed to the Supreme Court's decision in the Obergefell ruling and supports the decision of any elected and/or appointed official challenging that unconstitutional decision. Greene County officials adopted a similar statement. They pointed out that since this country's founding, the states have regulated and defined marriage without interference from the federal government or its courts. In McMinn County, officials cited the 9th and 10th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution, saying, quote, "It reserves all powers not explicitly delegated to the federal government to the people and the states," unquote. Votes in two counties were unanimous and only two dissented in the third. Several other counties in the state passed resolutions praying that God would pass over them the judgment due to America for this egregious sin. It will not help save Americans from God's coming wrath, but it might remind the nation. A life-size replica of Noah's Ark will be open to the public on July 7, 2016. The massive construction project, a subsidiary of Answers in Genesis, is set to be the largest tourist attraction in America outside of Disney and Universal. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day when Noah entered the ark, and they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Matthew 24. And that's the world view on this Monday, November 16th, in the year of our Lord, 2015. I'm Adam McManus. Seize the day for Jesus Christ. The United States Supreme Court on Friday agreed to hear the first major pro-life case since 2007. I'm Adam McManus, in for Kevin Swanson on this edition of Generations Radio. You can learn more about me at my website and my 20 years in talk radio all around this nation, adammcmanus.net. That's MCManus.net. Would love to hear from you. My guest by telephone line is Cheryl Sullinger, Senior Vice President for Operation Rescue. They are the ones that helped to put together what has become the case that the Supreme Court has agreed to take up as of Friday, involving the 2013 Texas law, HB2, that requires abortion facilities to meet minimum health and safety standards, and that abortionists maintain hospital privileges within 30 miles of their abortion facilities. Now, before we get into the specifics of the law and what the Supreme Court may or may not do and why this is so important for the pro-life movement, Cheryl, give us the background on what led to that law, your 2011 undercover investigation into dozens of the 40 Texas abortion mills at that time.
Well, what we found in Texas in 2011 was that every abortion clinic we looked at had some violations going on there. Those violations ranged from violations of the 24-hour informed consent law and HIPAA violations. There were patient records thrown in open trash bins that could have been easily accessed by anybody. And there were also the illegal disposal of aborted baby remains, for which two whole women's health abortion clinics were heavily fined. And so there were a lot of situations going on at these abortion clinics that we believed were actually posing a danger to women and a danger to public health. And so we filed complaints, of course, against these clinics and a couple of abortionists. In fact, two abortionists were also fined and disciplined by the medical board.
Were you surprised that fines and discipline were the results of your investigations?
No, we were not surprised at all. In fact, we hoped that that would be the outcome, that there would be disciplinary action, because we thought that some of the things that we found were really egregious. For example, the 24-hour informed consent law in Texas states that a doctor has to be on this conference call 24 hours in advance of abortions for women, that he has to be live and he has to be available to answer questions. But what we found were most of the conference calls actually had a recording from an abortionist, and there was no one there to answer anyone's calls. And in fact, in some cases, the recordings were so garbled, you couldn't understand a word anyone was saying. And
I'm surprised, frankly, that there was even a conference call. I would be under the impression that an informed consent law requiring that a patient be given informed consent 24 hours before she goes through with the abortion so that she's able to have all the facts and make an informed decision, presumably, that she would do that in person at the abortion mill. I wasn't even aware that these were set up for conference calls at all, much less the fact that the abortionists were trying to get around the requirement, the legal requirement, with these pre-recorded, even garbled phone messages.
Right. You know, but what we've seen across the country is that when you try to add an extra visit to an abortion appointment, the abortionists usually challenge those in the court, claiming that they pose an undue burden for women, that, you know, having to come to the abortion clinic twice instead of once is just way too much to expect from anybody, you know. But you're right, that's how it should be done. But unfortunately, that is not how it is done in a vast majority of states in this country. Actually, in Texas, they at least require that someone is live on the phone to answer questions. In a lot of states, all that women have to do is access a form online and sign it within 24 hours of their appointment, and that serves as informed consent, and we believe that's totally inadequate.
I want to talk further about HB2 that became law in 2013 that has now gone to the Supreme Court, and we'll talk about that in greater detail. But first, Cheryl Sellinger of Operation Rescue, there was great concern by pro-lifers, understandably, and frankly, anyone of conscience, that through your undercover investigation of 2011 into the Texas abortion mills, and again, you didn't do just one or two, you looked into dozens, you actually have on tape recorded audio of abortion mill workers at Whole Women's Health, for example, in McAllen, Texas, telling the boyfriend of an underage pregnant girl that she, the worker at the abortion mill, will not report him for rape. And I would think that in large measure, many of these underage girls who have quote unquote older boyfriends are either the victims of incest or some sleazeball on Facebook or some party somewhere taking advantage of a young girl, and then she gets pregnant. And really, because she's underage, it is quantifiably a rape and should be reported to the appropriate legal authorities by the abortion mill, but they repeatedly do not report it.
That's correct. In fact, it's not just a problem in Texas. That's a systemic problem throughout the United States. We also discovered one abortion clinic in Texas. It was actually in El Paso. The same abortionist had another abortion facility about 2 miles away across the state lines into New Mexico. And so what he would do is he would take the underage girls from Texas, and in order to avoid having to comply with the parental consent law there, they would refer these girls to the New Mexico abortion clinic where there is no parental consent required. So what they were doing is helping these girls avoid the parental consent laws by going across state lines to the other abortion clinic that this guy set up.
You found all kinds of records that should have been properly shredded in the dumpster, numerous patient charts, receipts, ledgers, private medical paperwork with full names, birth dates, addresses, phone numbers, financial information, procedural details. I mean, this is in direct violation of every medical standard there is. I mean, people should have the right of privacy.
You know, and it's so hypocritical because one of the things that abortionists do in order to keep them, like, submitting to the records for inspection, for example, is that they claim patient privacy and HIPAA and everything else, that they want to protect their patient privacy. Like, that's the number one, you know, thing, you know, priority, you know, at their clinic is patient privacy. But yet over and over again, we saw that the abortion clinics would just dump the sensitive information into the dumpsters, open dumpsters that like animals were getting into, papers flying all up and down these alleyways and everything. So this was sensitive information that should have been shredded. It wasn't shredded. It was just dumped in the dumpster, in a pretty sloppy manner, really, with no concern for the privacy of these patients. And so whenever you hear an abortion clinic, try to take the high road and say that they're so concerned about the privacy of these women, we know that that's really not true. It's really a hypocritical claim on their part.
Cheryl Sullinger, my guest, Senior Vice President for Operation Rescue. You can learn more all about this, the story, and the fact that it's the Supreme Court will be taking the first major pro-life case up into their examination as of Friday at operationrescue.org. You'll see it on the top left corner under top stories. That's operationrescue.org. The other thing you found in your 2011 undercover look into the hideousness of several dozen abortion mills of Texas was improperly and illegally dumped biohazard and infectious medical waste, often wrapped in blue paper. What was found?
Well, we found these packets. For every abortion, there was a packet. And each one of these packets would have the bloody cannulas that were used on the suction machine to accomplish the abortion.
What is a cannula?
A cannula, it's a long plastic tube, and it's attached to the suction hose on the suction machine. And the cannula is actually the instrument that actually suctions out the inside of the womb. And so the body parts of the baby go up inside the tube.
And for people to understand this and how powerful this abortion suction machine is, 80% of abortions are done this way in America in the first trimester. It is 29 times more powerful than your home vacuum cleaner. So you can imagine what it does to the poor baby, ripping it piece by piece through this tube. But if improperly inserted into the woman's womb, can literally perforate her uterus and cause all kinds of serious attack on her body, including leading to death through bleeding that cannot be stopped.
That's true. That's exactly true. And so there needs to be a certain level of skill involved in doing abortions. It's a blind procedure. And, we see a lot of complications. We've seen complications at Whole Women's Health in Texas, for example, those very kinds of heavy bleeding and perforated uterus. We've seen those things at abortion clinics in Texas. And so, we're always concerned about the women's safety. We're concerned about the baby that always dies during the abortion, but we're also concerned about the women and their safety, especially when we are see who is doing these abortions. And a lot of times the abortionists that are employed at these abortion clinics are really pretty much bottom of the barrel providers. And so we know that the chances of complications are going to go up higher because these people are not skilled.
When we're talking about the second and third trimester abortions, the abortionist literally is cutting the child piece by piece inside the womb. And I remember distinctly when I was picketing with a group of pro-lifers outside an abortion mill in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, during my days at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina, and the abortionist, who was in his mid-30s and looked like he was about ready to throw in the towel, he was so, I think, numbed to what he was doing and recognized ultimately the horror of what he was doing. He said in a moment of absolute candor, Cheryl, that he has to have the nurse or his assistant piece back together all the different pieces of the baby that he has just dismembered and killed, like a bloody puzzle, to make sure that no piece of the baby has now remained inside the woman's womb. I mean, this is the bloody truth of what goes on behind closed doors and abortion mills at a million plus times and on an annual basis. I mean, is that an accurate description of those second and third trimester abortions?
Yes, that is accurate. Now, of course, the later ones, sometimes they'll try to induce labor so that the babies are born more intact. And frankly, we've found out recently from the Center of Medical Progress's videos that the reason for that is because they actually are harvesting organs in order to make a little extra money for the clinic, you know, by selling them for research. And, you know, we have long suspected that was going on, but we're finally able to get the proof in the CMP videos. And, in fact, in Texas, in Houston, a Planned Parenthood down there was one that was really very, very involved in that whole process.
You discovered in these dumpsters, again, not properly disposed of at all, partial remains of aborted babies, putrefying, sadly, in open dumpsters where animals or people could encounter them. I mean, it is about the lowest of the low, isn't it? Not only to kill innocent children, baby boys and baby girls, but to leave their body parts that have been dismembered, you know, in a dumpster like trash.
Yeah, it's appalling. It's appalling that they do that. And we actually did find identifiable baby remains. And when the health department went back to do an inspection based on our complaint, they found more. And so even though Whole Women's Health understood that we had this, what we had discovered, and they knew we had filed complaints, they still continued that pattern of behavior, knowing it was completely illegal. And like I said, they were fined for that. But if you go to our website and check out that top story that you were talking about on the left hand, in the top of the left hand column, you'll see the actual dumpsters that we made those discoveries in. And you can see that they're overflowing. There's trash on the ground around them. They're completely open. And it's not just, you know, it is appalling the way that they treat these unborn babies, the way they treat these little baby boys and girls as just trash, but also it causes a public health. There's a public health issue to that because you just can't be throwing stuff like that in an open dumpster because it can spread disease. And so
they're supposed to have a biohazard medical pickup service that ultimately incinerates all of the contents that they pick up, correct?
Yes, that's correct. And I guess they were saving money by doing that. But also, we also found out inadvertently as a result of our investigation, we didn't actually find this out during our investigation, but as a result, when the health department inspected, they found out also that Stericycle was improperly disposing of the remains they were picking up from other clinics, Whole Women's Health clinics. And so they were actually fined as well. So actually, that was a public service. You know, people criticize us sometimes for, you know, we got a lot of the things out of the trash can. We had one of our people down there in McAllen, Texas, and they had those trash cans laying everywhere in that alley. They just picked them up and inspected them and made discoveries, you know. So, but this is the kind of thing that goes on all the time at abortion clinics. In fact, disposing of aborted baby remains is one of the biggest problems that abortion clinics actually have.
Mm. Cheryl Sullinger is my guest, Senior Vice President for Operation Rescue. You can learn more at their top story on their homepage, OperationRescue.org. I'm Adam McManus in for Kevin Swanson. Would love to hear from you about your feedback on this particular broadcast. You can reach me through my website, AdamMcManus.net, MCManus.net. You can also email me directly at TalkRadioAdam@gmail.com. Love to hear from Generations Radio listeners. I always respond to each and every email. That's TalkRadioAdam@gmail.com. So on Friday, the United States Supreme Court said it would hear the first major pro-life case since 2007 when it takes up a case involving a 2013 Texas law, HB2, that again came about in part because of the informative and eye-opening and revealing undercover investigation that Operation Rescue did back in 2011 of dozens of abortion mills in Texas. Now, the law required a couple things. One, that abortion facilities meet minimum health and safety standards. And two, that abortionists maintain hospital privileges within 30 miles of the abortion mills. Now, sadly, the facility standards portion of the law was blocked from enforcement. And that's a whole nother can of worms, I suppose. But the hospital privilege requirement, requiring that abortionists themselves, the doctors who are killing these baby boys and girls, that they have to have hospital privileges within 30 miles of the abortion mills, because oftentimes what they do in the abortion mills leads to very serious life-threatening situations. In fact, a number of women die because of perforated uteruses, et cetera, internal bleeding from the suction cannula that has now not just killed the baby, but has dramatically harmed the woman who wants her baby to be killed. Interestingly, the actual bill, HB 2, that passed in 2013 in Texas, resulted, Cheryl, in the closure of fully 50%, 50%, half of the state's abortion mills. That caused the abortion rate to decrease dramatically in Texas by an amazing 13% in the following year. I mean, that's saving a lot of babies, isn't it?
That's saving a lot of babies. And, you know, when abortion clinics close, what happens is women they have a little bit more time to think and they find other ways to deal with the challenges in their lives than taking the life of their baby. A lot of times women will think, well, I'll just call this abortion clinic that I know about and get an abortion. They call and find out it's closed. A lot of times they take that as, you know, God telling them not to kill their baby. You know what I mean? And so we see a lot of women that just say, you know what, it's just, I'm just going to keep my baby, or I'm going to release my baby for adoption instead. And so closing these abortion clinics actually saves lives. It's quantifiable.
Well, and I can speak to this issue directly. My eldest son, Honor, who is 6, the eldest of 3, Mercy is 4, and Valor is now 8 months. Our eldest son is adopted, and he comes to us from a loving, sacrificial couple where I live in San Antonio, Texas. This couple, not surprisingly, had conceived this child out of wedlock, had actually considered very seriously aborting that child, our son. And thankfully, they chose life, and they chose to place that wonderful baby boy into our home. And I think that, you know, with all the couples that have had difficulty getting pregnant, we had had an ectopic pregnancy, we had had a miscarriage, lost 3 children, including that miscarriage of identical twins. There are so many listeners to Generations Radio who have lost children through stillbirth or miscarriage or ectopic pregnancies, and they can understand and identify with the emotional pain that we went through. But just think about how many homes could be blessed if more young people, especially having these children out of wedlock, would consider placing the children into loving arms.
Right, and there's hundreds of thousands of couples out there. In fact, I think one of the statistics I read recently was about 2 million couples a year are on the list waiting to adopt children. And with only about 1.2 million abortions in this country, if all abortions ceased and the babies were placed into adoptive homes, we still wouldn't be able to fill the need there.
And by the way, unlike the liberal media's stereotype of those couples that want to adopt, people are not just interested in adopting perfectly formed, blue-eyed, blonde-haired baby white boys. They're open to adopting children of any race, including those who might have specific mental challenges, Down syndrome or what have you. I think we've seen an abundance, for example, of Christians adopting through the foster care systems of their respective states, and even China adoptions, and many from Haiti after the earthquake hit.
Right. And so, yeah, that's true. There are many, many families that are willing to take a special needs child. They're willing to take a child of any race because they just have love in their heart.
Exactly.
That they want to give to a child, and you know, race or whatever doesn't really matter.
I want to get back to this crazy notion. How is it possible that someone can go through medical school and be certified to, for example, do abortions and then not have admitting privileges to a hospital within 5 miles, much less a 30-mile radius? How is it possible? I mean, are the abortionists of today despised by the medical community themselves and they don't want to have anything to do with them?
Yeah, that's a big part of it. That really is. Hospitals are in the business to heal and help people, and they know that abortion clinics are in a different business. They're in a killing business, and so they don't want to be tainted by that. They know that there's a large part of the population that is against abortion, that doesn't really want to be in a medical facility where abortions are taking place. And so, of course, they don't want to grant hospital privileges to abortionists. But there's also a couple other reasons. One is that a lot of the abortionists have a lot of disciplinary issues, and they pose too great of a liability to the hospitals.
Yes, I see.
And then a third thing, a third component to this, is that a lot of these abortionists actually travel from one city to another during these abortions. So
and some are even from out of state.
Right. So they don't actually live in the community where the abortion clinic is.
Mm.
And because of that, the hospital, again, does not want to incur the liability of having to grant privileges to a doctor who will come in to town, do a few abortions, leave that night, and when complications arise after the fact, they're not available to treat the women.
Cheryl, I love what you said in your press statement. You said, if abortionists cannot qualify for hospital privileges, they're not even qualified to conduct the surgical abortion initially that sometimes places the lives of women in jeopardy. We're excited, you said, that the Texas case will be heard by the Supreme Court next year and are optimistic that it will be upheld as constitutional.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, we honestly, the 30-mile hospital privilege rule was one of the components to that law that we heavily support. In fact, we're the ones that recommended that. And so that's been successful at actually saving lives in all the states that have actually implemented that. This is like a really, really important thing for the health and safety of women. This is if this law is struck down, then what we call fly-by-night abortionists, people that fly in, they do the abortions, and they leave, that will become even more prevalent than it is already. And that, we believe, puts women's lives at risk.
You can learn all about this particular development of the Supreme Court taking up their first major pro-life case since 2007 at the website operationrescue.org on the left-hand side under top stories. And as Cheryl indicated, lots of details on those undercover investigations they did dating back to 2011. Thankfully, as a result of the passage of HB 2, House Bill 2 in Texas, nearly 50% of the abortion mills had to close because half of their abortionists did not qualify to have hospital admitting privileges within a 30-mile radius. The case specifically is entitled Whole Woman's Health, which is the name of a series of abortion mills, rather ironically. They're not interested in the whole woman's health. If they were, they wouldn't be killing the children of the mother. And they would be concerned about the emotional and psychological and spiritual component of the woman's health. They're not interested in the whole woman's health. It's all about this kind of brave new world changing of the meaning of words, isn't it? When an abortion clinic comes up with a name, it's usually the absolute opposite of what they stand for, isn't it, Cheryl?
Yeah, and it's interesting that they pick these innocuous names also.
Yeah, exactly.
That just do not tell what they really
do. The case name is Whole Woman's Health versus Cole. Cole referring to Kirk Cole, the commissioner of the Texas Department of State Health Services. It's the U.S. Supreme Court case number 16-274, and you say they will be taking this up for consideration next year. One final component to our conversation, Cheryl Sullinger, and that is, in light of the Supreme Court makeup today, the one that's given us the June 26th Obergefell pro-homosexual marriage ruling, are we likely to see a pro-abortion decision for them to overturn HB2 that became law in Texas in 2013, leading to a cut in abortions by 13%? Or are we likely to see them uphold this pro-life law? What is your thought?
Well, I think they're going to uphold it. And the reason I think that is because a lot of times Supreme Court decisions depend on the quality of the case. So if a case goes up and it has bad facts, you're probably not going to win. You know what I mean? No matter whether or not you're morally right or not, you know, based on the law, if it's a case with bad facts, then you're going to have problems when it gets up there. But for this case, we believe this is a case where we have good facts because we can show beyond a shadow of a doubt that the components of HB2 actually help women. They actually are beneficial to women, and they actually are a standard of care that is pretty much uniform, like throughout medicine, you know. So all we're asking these abortion clinics really to do is meet the same standards that any other doctor would have to meet, you know.
Example, when I go into a podiatrist, if the podiatrist is doing something with, I don't know, an ingrown toenail or a bunion and something goes wrong and he needs to get me rushed to the hospital and he doesn't have hospital admitting privileges or he doesn't have proper standard of care or doesn't dispose of medical, biohazard material properly, it would make you wonder, what are they doing? This is below proper ethical standard of care.
Right, that's correct. And so that's what abortion clinics want to do, though. They want to be able to operate below the standard of care because that helps them cut corners on their costs so they can actually increase their profits. Mm. Because for abortion clinics, that's really what it's about. They have a bottom line that they have to meet like any other business, and they're not just there to break even. They're there to make money.
Well, I sure hope that our listeners to Generations Radio will consider a donation to Operation Rescue through the website, operationrescue.org. You all are doing one of the most important works on earth, next to the gospel of Christ going forth. This is something that God speaks to in Scripture time and time again. He lists seven things he hates in Proverbs 6, and one of them is the shedding of innocent blood. Psalm 139, 13 through 16, you can look it up. Of course, it talks about we were created in our mother's womb before one of those days had even come to pass, and God was there in the midst of it, and he has a specific design and plan in mind for each and every one of these baby boys and girls. And when one of these children who are created in his image, their life is taken, it is about the lowest of the low. And the fact that Christians in the body of Christ have tolerated for far, far too long, for these 40-plus years, 55 million baby boys and baby girls have lost their lives. The blood cries out for justice from the ground, and I hope that the Supreme Court will do the right thing next year and uphold the HB2 law of Texas that helped to reduce abortions here in this state, the Lone Star State, by 13%. Thank you, Cheryl Sullinger, Senior Vice President of Operation Rescue, for your fantastic work.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
I'm Adam McManus in for Kevin Swanson on this edition of Generations Radio. I'll be here over the next 2 days on Tuesday and Wednesday as well. Please send me an email with your feedback about this particular broadcast and interview. TalkRadioAdam@gmail.com. TalkRadioAdam@gmail.com and my website, AdamMcManus.net. See you next time.